Right, so the funny thing about this leak, if you can call any of this funny, is that it finally puts in writing what a lot of people have been saying for years, but were dismissed as conspiratorial for even hinting at it. Because if you'd told anyone a decade ago that the convicted trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, a former Israeli prime minister, the Rothschild banking dynasty, and the world's most notorious offensive cyber industry were all turning up in the same email chain, well, they'd have laughed it off as internet nonsense, wouldn't they? And yet here we are, with various reports all coming out, all holding pieces of the same puzzle. The surprise isn't that these people knew each other. The surprise is that the documents have surfaced at all, and that they show exactly the kind of pipeline everyone was told didn't actually exist. Right, so the thing to grasp from the start of this story is that it feels explosive because people are treating it like four separate scandals stacked on top of each other. Epstein, Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, Rothschild Finance, and Israel's offensive cyber weapons trade. But the moment you look at the sources, you realise these aren't four stories, they're four strands of the same system. And the reason it's all coming out now is because the leak has given us a written record that shows exactly how these strands fit together. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. You stop thinking in terms of individuals and start thinking in terms of the machinery behind what was going on here, because the emails, the Epstein emails, don't show a conspiracy, they show a network. And the network makes far more sense than the personalities themselves ever did. So let's start with Epstein, because everything else sits on top of that. You can't understand the leak without understanding who Epstein actually was in the political ecosystem. And the problem is that the public version of Epstein's story is too small. People reduce him to a trafficker, and he was a trafficker. That part is ugly and proven. But if he had only been that, he would have been isolated, not embraced. The bigger truth, the one the various news outlets have been documenting, is that Epstein built a network of influence that survived a criminal conviction because his role was more than social. He was a broker. He was a connector. He was the person powerful people went to when they wanted an introduction they couldn't make themselves, or when they needed funding from someone who didn't want their fingerprints on it. The logs show it. A document review identified over 100 meetings between Epstein and elites from 2013 through to 2017, a period where any normal political or financial figure would have cut ties with him for reputational survival. But Epstein didn't lose access. He gained it. That only happens if you're offering something more valuable than the cost of being seen with you. And in Epstein's case, the value he offered was discretion, influence, and introductions across sectors that don't normally overlap. Academia, politics, finance, intelligence, emerging tech. When a man like that is still meeting high-level actors after a conviction, it's because he's structurally useful, not socially tolerated. And that's the key to understanding why the leaked emails place him exactly where he appears, as the go-between linking Ehud Barak and Ariane de Rothschild. It looks shocking if you think of Epstein as a disgraced socialite. It makes perfect sense if you think of him as what he functionally was, a private political and financial conduit. Epstein relayed messages between Barak and Ariane de Rothschild, including the line from Ariane telling Barak that if he wants to make serious money, he needs to build a relationship with her. That line isn't gossip, it isn't innuendo, it's written evidence that the head of one of the most powerful private banking dynasties in Europe was signalling willingness to work with a former Israeli prime minister, and that Epstein was the one making the introductions. Now, the thing to remember is that this wasn't a first contact. The record confirms that the Edmond de Rothschild group had multiple meetings with Epstein between 2013 and 2019. That's 6 years of access. And in 2015, her group signed a $25 million contract with Epstein's Southern Trust for what was described as risk analysis and algorithmic application, which is exactly the kind of vague, high-tech terminology banks use when they want to describe something without explaining it. The point is that the relationship was already active, already financial, already structured. The email simply shows Epstein trying to expand the relationship by adding Barak into the mix. And this is where people make the mistake of assuming this must have been some kind of secretive or unusual thing. Truth is far simpler than that. This is how private capital simply circulates. Banks like the Edmond de Rothschild Group, they don't operate like retail banks. They don't serve the public at all. They don't come under the same kind of scrutiny. They operate behind closed doors with donor-advised funds and umbrella vehicles and private wealth instruments and discretionary investment structures all designed to move money with quiet efficiency. If you want capital that comes without political oversight, that's the institution you go to, isn't it? And if you're a high-ranking political or military figure who wants to monetize expertise that came from state service, well, you don't go through the official channels. You go through people who understand that kind of discretion that is needed, and Epstein very much understood that. Rothschild Private Banking understood it too, and Barak needed it. Which brings us to the second strand, which is Ehud Barak himself. And the thing you see immediately with Barak is that he is not some passive figure who somehow got dragged into Epstein's orbit. He's been in that orbit for decades. Haaretz reported in 2019 that Epstein invested $2.3 million into Barak's investment company in the mid-2000s. You don't take that kind of money from someone you don't know, do you? And you don't forget someone who bankrolls your ventures either. So when Barak showed up in these emails years later asking Epstein about cybertech opportunities and the recruitment of people from Unit 81, that's not out of place, that's continuity. That's an old relationship being activated for a new purpose. Now consider who Barak was and what he represented. As a former Prime Minister and former Defence Minister of Israel, he sat on top of the state's most sensitive intelligence and military structures. He oversaw units that later became the backbone of Israel's offensive cyber industry. When he leaves government and steps into private tech, he isn't entering a different world. He's stepping sideways into a commercial extension of the state. His involvement with Reportee, later renamed Carbine, fits perfectly into that pattern. Carbine markets itself as an emergency services platform, but its core is geolocation and data access technology built by people connected to Unit 8200, Israel's shady and secretive signals intelligence agency, whose alumni populate Israel's cyber export sector, and of course, have gone on to work elsewhere in places like Meta. And this is where the Pegasus context comes in. People forget the scale of Israel's cyber export problem because they get hung up on NSO as if it were just one company that went rogue. But the Pegasus project confirmed that NSO spyware had been deployed against around 50,000 phone numbers worldwide. Its use was documented in at least 50 countries, targeting journalists, dissidents, political opposition figures, and human rights activists. And there have been multiple follow-up investigations showing other Israeli companies, such as Candiru, a company that shares its name with an Amazonian fish that does deeply unpleasant things to you if you happen to pee in the river, were running similar tools as well. The reason this matters to Barak is that he comes from the ecosystem that produces the talent these companies rely on. So when the leaked emails show Barak discussing startups staffed by Unit 81 veterans, well, the implication is obvious, or should be. He was trying to build or finance the next generation of exactly the kind of offensive tech that Israel has already been exporting. And this is the part where the strands start to converge, because Barak does not go looking for funding through public channels. He does not apply for state grants. He does not open discussions with Israeli institutions that would require transparency. He goes straight to Epstein, who then goes straight to the Rothschild Bank. And that decision tells you everything. It tells you that Barak wanted capital that wasn't scrutinized. It tells you he wanted partners who understood secrecy. And it tells you he wanted to commercialize intelligence-adjacent expertise without the Israeli state being publicly involved. And now you can see why the leaked emails matter, can't you? Because the leak isn't revealing that Barak wanted to build cyber tools. We already knew he was involved in that space. It isn't revealing that Epstein connected powerful people. We already knew that, too. It isn't revealing that Rothschild Banking did business with Epstein. We already had that in black and white as far back as 2019. What the leak reveals is that these three strands were not separate. They were all part of the same pipeline. And the only reason we are seeing it now is because the Barak inbox dataset was hacked, captured, and published. And once those messages exist, once the written record is out there, the line between private capital, ex-state military expertise, and compromised intermediaries becomes impossible to deny. So here's the thing. Nothing about the leak is surprising if you already understand the way Israeli offensive cyber technology is built and funded. The state trains the operatives. The operatives leave the state and build private companies. The companies need capital. Capital does not come from Israel alone. It comes from private foreign banks, offshore vehicles, discrete intermediaries, and networks that understand both the value and the sensitivity of offensive technology. And the leak shows Barak trying to tap exactly that structure. This is the point most people miss, and it's why we need to pause on it before moving on to the other strands. The emails don't show Epstein, Barak, and Rothschild conspiring. They show them behaving normally within the logic of the system that they occupy. Epstein connects, Rothschild funds, Barak builds, and the Israeli cyber industry monetizes military expertise outside democratic oversight. That's the structure, that's the point. So now we get to that third strand, which is Israel's offensive cyber industry itself, because if you don't understand the nature of that ecosystem, you miss why the Barak-Epstein-Rothschild alignment is such a clean fit. Israel hasn't just built a strong cyber sector, it has built the most notorious offensive cyber export model on earth. And this didn't happen in secret. it happened in daylight through companies whose abuses have been documented by investigative outlets across the world. Pegasus wasn't an outlier, it was the flagship. When the Pegasus project identified around 50,000 potential targets, what they were exposing was the industrial scale of Israel's spyware deployment. When this was traced to the presence of Israeli spyware across at least 50 countries, they were showing how these tools had become everyday instruments of repression. And you can see the rhythm of it. Israeli military intelligence trains the operatives. The operatives leave, form the private companies, and build the products using that same expertise. And these products are then sold to governments, often through opaque intermediaries, offshore companies, shell structures that leave political responsibility floating somewhere between the state, the company, and the client. Israel gets plausible deniability, the private company gets profit, the client gets the ability to surveil or infiltrate opponents without the political blowback of developing such tools domestically. And the global rights community gets another funeral, or another court case, or another investigative report showing how spyware was used to ruin someone's life. That's the model. Now, when you understand that model, Barak's presence in this ecosystem stops looking like a curiosity and starts looking like continuity. He's the embodiment of the pipeline. The state official stepping into private tech, monetizing intelligence-adjacent capabilities, drawing talent from units like 8200 and 81, and bringing in external capital to fund tools that operate in the shadows. His involvement in Carbine is a public example. The leaked cyber startup discussions with Unit 81 personnel are a private example. The difference is only one of visibility. The function is the same. And this then brings us on to that fourth and last strand, the Rothschild finance. And before anyone starts getting distracted, this isn't about myth. This isn't about conspiratorial fantasy. This is about a documented business relationship and a set of financial mechanisms that are objectively useful for anyone who wants to move money quietly. The Edmond de Rothschild Group is a real institution with real global reach, and their business model is very simple. Private wealth management, high-value clients, discrete investment structures, offshore-capable finance, and cross-border capital allocation. When it was confirmed in 2019 that they had multiple meetings with Epstein between 2013 and 2019, when it was revealed that there was a $25 million contract between the bank's group and Southern Trust, what that showed was that Epstein wasn't a casual acquaintance, he was a client too, a business partner, and a known figure inside their circles. And that matters because it tells you why Epstein, of all people, was in the position to relay a message from Ariane de Rothschild to Ehud Barak, saying that if he wanted to make serious money, he needed to build a relationship with her. This wasn't flattery, it wasn't hypothetic, it was a signal from a bank that already had a financial relationship with Epstein, telling Barak that a pathway existed for him. And when you know who Barak was, what he was trying to build, what kind of technology was under discussion, the implication becomes unavoidable. Epstein was trying to bring Rothschild Finance into a pipeline that could be used for Israeli cyber technology development. And here's the part that makes everything fall into place. This is exactly the kind of funding structure Israel's offensive cyber industry relies on. It's not funded by the Israeli state alone. It's funded by private capital, discrete partners, high net worth individuals, and offshore vehicles that can absorb risk and avoid oversight. The entire model depends on using private market mechanisms to commercialize state-produced capability. So when the leak shows Epstein trying to bring a private banking dynasty with offshore reach into a conversation with a former Israeli PM about cyber tech staffed by intelligence veterans, that's not suspicious. That's the architecture working the way it was designed to work. And this is where the four strands all now converge, and the picture becomes something you can actually draw a line through. You have Epstein in the middle, passing messages, offering introductions, structuring investment ideas, and putting people in the same orbit. You have Barak on one side, carrying military and intelligence expertise into the private sector, looking for capital to build or back cyber tools that operate on the boundary between security and surveillance. You have Rothschild Finance on the other side offering the kind of discrete capital structures that allow sensitive technologies to be funded without state oversight or public scrutiny. And between them sits the global offensive cyber industry that Israel has been exporting for years. The one already responsible for Pegasus and Candiru and every other spyware scandal currently sitting in the courts and inquiries around the world. Now people will ask the predictable question, I dare say. Does this prove that the Rothschild Bank funded Israeli offensive cyber weapons? And the answer is no, because there's no evidence of a completed transaction for cyber weapon development through Rothschild vehicles. That part of the pipeline has not been documented. But the question itself misses the point, because the relevant question isn't, did the money move? It's, why were these actors all in the same room, and what were they trying to build? And that's where the leak is devastating, because what it proves is that the pipeline existed. The introductions were being made. The interest did align. Epstein was brokering. Barack was recruiting. Rothschild Finance was engaged. And the entire ecosystem of Israeli offensive cyber exports sits in the background, providing the context that makes the conversations meaningful. And once you see that, you understand why none of the actors involved wanted this leak to surface. Epstein is dead, but his network lives on in documents that expose how deep his connections were. Barack is politically marginal now, but his private activities still reveal the line between state expertise and private profit. Rothschild Finance has spent years trying to avoid being drawn into the reputational gravity of Epstein because their business depends on discretion. And Israel is still dealing with the fallout of Pegasus, with governments and courts across the world investigating how Israeli spyware was used against activists and political opponents. None of these people want to be seen in the same orbit as each other, but they were. And now the emails prove it. So the consequence is simple. You don't need to claim a conspiracy here. You don't need to pretend the leak shows more than it does. You just need to follow the structure the leak makes visible. Epstein connected the political world, the financial world, and the intelligence-adjacent tech world. Barack carried state knowledge into the private market. Rothschild Finance offered discrete cross-border capital. And Israel's cyber industry provided the tools and talent that made the whole arrangement valuable. And once you see the machinery, you understand the politics. And the politics is this. The offensive cyber weapons that have been wrecking democracies across the world are not the byproduct of rogue actors. They're the commercial offspring of state intelligence, private finance, and compromised intermediaries, all working in sync. So here's the verdict. The emails don't prove the money was deployed into cyber weapon development, but they don't have to. What they prove is that the network existed, the actors were aligned, and the structure was already in place. And once you see the structure, you see the truth that sits underneath all of this. The leak hasn't revealed a scandal here. It's revealed the business model behind the scandal. And the business model has been working exactly as it was intended to. Of course, nobody is mentioned in the Epstein emails more than Donald Trump is. And while he might think he's playing it clever by now saying the full Epstein files should be released, he might well regret that if he's the number one name in the emails. How much more may we learn if Donnie doesn't double-cross us all on this and walk back on it? But to get the details of what we learned most recently right here, please do also hit like, share and subscribe if you haven't done so already, so as to ensure you don't miss out on all new daily content, as well as spreading the word and helping to support the channel at the same time, which is very much appreciated. Holding power to account for ordinary working class people. And I'll hopefully catch you on the next one. Cheers, folks.